Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. We're up to Book 7, Chapter 10. "Does it ever happen to you?" said Natasha to her brother when they had settled down in the sitting room. "Does it ever happen to you to feel as if there were nothing more to come, nothing, that everything good is past, and to feel not exactly dull but sad?" "I should think so," he replied. "I have felt like that when everything was all right and everyone was cheerful. The thought has come into my mind that I was already tired of it all, and that we must all die. Once, in the regiment, I had not gone to some merrymaking where there was music, and suddenly I felt so depressed."
"Oh, yes, I know, Natasha interrupted. "When I was quite little, that used to be so with me. Do you remember when I was punished once about some plums? You were all dancing and I sat sobbing in the schoolroom. I shall never forget it. I felt sad and sorry for everyone, for myself and for everyone."
"And I was innocent. That was the chief thing," said Natasha. "Do you remember?"
"I remember," answered Nicholas. "I remember that I came to you afterwards and wanted to comfort you, but do you know, I felt ashamed to. We were terribly absurd. I had a funny doll then and wanted to give it to you. Do you remember?"
"And do you remember," Natasha asked with a pensive smile, "how once, long, long ago, when we were quite little, Uncle called us into the study. That was in the old house. And it was dark. We went in and suddenly there stood..."
"A Negro," chimed in Nicholas with a smile of delight. "Of course I remember. Even now I don't know whether there really was a Negro, or if we only dreamt it or were told about him. He was grey, you remember, and had white teeth and stood and looked at us."
"Sonia, do you remember?" asked Nicholas.
Yes, I do remember something too," Sonia answered timidly.
"You know, I have asked Papa and Mama about the Negro," said Natasha, "and they say there was no Negro at all. But you see, you remember."
"Of course I do. I remember his teeth as if I had just seen them. How strange it is. It's as if it were a dream. I like that.
And do you remember how we rolled hard-boiled eggs in the ballroom and suddenly two old women began spinning round on the carpet? Was that real or not? Do you remember what fun it was?"
"Yes, and you remember how Papa in his blue overcoat fired a gun in the porch."
So they went through their memories, smiling with pleasure. Not the sad memories of old age, but poetic, youthful ones. Those impressions of one's most distant past in which dreams and realities blend, and they laughed with quiet enjoyment. Sonia, as always, did not quite keep pace with them, though they shared the same reminiscences. Much that they remembered had slipped from their mind, and what she recalled did not arouse the same poetic feeling as it did as for them. She simply enjoyed their pleasure and tried to fit in with it. She only really took part when they recalled Sonia's first arrival. She told them how afraid she had been of Nicholas because he had on a corded jacket and her nurse had told her that she, too, would be sewn up with cords.
"And I remember their telling me that you had been born under a cabbage," said Natasha. "And I remember that I dared not disbelieve it then, but knew it was not true, and I felt so uncomfortable."
While they were talking, a maid thrust her head in at the other door of the sitting room. "They have brought the cock, miss," she said in a whisper.
"It isn't wanted, Polya. Tell them to take it away," replied Natasha.
In the middle of their talk in the sitting room, Dimla came in and went up to the harp that stood in the corner. He took off its cloth covering and the harp gave out a jarring sound.
"Mr. Dimla, please play my favourite nocturne by Field," came the old countess's voice from the drawing room. Dimla struck a chord and, turning to Natasha, Nicholas and Sonia, remarked, "How quiet you young people are." Yes, we're philosophizing, said Natasha, glancing round for a moment and then continuing the conversation. They were now discussing dreams. Dimmler began to play. Natasha went on tiptoe noiselessly to the table, took up a candle, carried it out and returned, seating herself quietly in her former place. It was dark in the room, especially where they were sitting on the sofa, but through the big windows of silvery light of the full moon fell on the floor. Dimmler had finished the piece, but still sat softly running his fingers over the strings, evidently uncertain whether to stop or to play something else. "Do you know," said Natasha in a whisper, moving closer to Nicholas and Sonya, "that when one goes on and on recalling memories, one at last begins to remember what happened before one was in the world?" "That is metempsychosis," said Sonya, who had always learned well and remembered everything. "The Egyptians believe that our souls have lived in animals and will go back into animals again." "No, I don't believe we were ever in animals," said Natasha, still in a whisper, though the music had ceased. "But I am certain that we were angels somewhere there and have been here, and that is why we remember." "May I join you?" said Dimmler, who had come up quietly and sat down by them. "If we have been angels, why have we fallen lower?" said Nicholas. "No, that can't be." "Not lower. Who said we were lower?" "How do I know what I was before?" Natasha rejoined with conviction. "The soul is immortal. Well then, if I shall always live, I must have lived before, lived for a whole eternity." "Yes, but it is hard for us to imagine eternity," remarked Dimmler, who had joined the young folk with a mildly condescending smile, but now spoke as quietly and seriously as they. "Why is it hard to imagine eternity?" said Natasha. "It is now today, and it will be tomorrow, and always, and there was yesterday, and the day before." "Natasha, now it's your turn. Sing me something," they heard the Countess say. "Why are you sitting there like conspirators?"
"Mama, I don't want at all to," replied Natasha, but all the same, she rose. None of them, not even the middle-aged Dimmler, wanted to break off their conversation and quit that corner in the sitting room, but Natasha got up and Nicholas sat down at the clavichord. Standing as usual in the middle of the hall and choosing the place where the resonance was best, Natasha began to sing her mother's favourite song. She had said she did not want to sing, but it was long since she had sung, and long before she again sang, as she did that evening. The Count, from his study, where he was talking to Mitenka, heard her, and like a schoolboy in a hurry to run out to play, blundered in his talk while giving orders to the steward, and at last stopped while Mitenka stood in front of him, also listening and smiling. Nicholas did not take his eyes off his sister and drew breath in time with her. Sonya, as she listened, thought of the immense difference there was between herself and her friend, and how impossible it was for her to be anything like as bewitching as her cousin. The old Countess sat with a blissful yet sad smile and with tears in her eyes, occasionally shaking her head. She thought of Natasha and of her own youth, and of how there was something unnatural and dreadful in this impending marriage of Natasha and Prince Andrew. Dimmler, who had seated himself beside the Countess, listened with closed eyes. "Ah, Countess," he said at last, "that's a European talent. She has nothing to learn. What softness, tenderness, and strength! Ah, how afraid I am for her, how afraid I am," said the Countess, not realizing to whom she was speaking. Her maternal instinct told her that Natasha had too much of something, and that because of this she would not be happy. Before Natasha had finally finished singing, 14-year-old Petya rushed in delightedly to say that some mummers had arrived. Natasha stopped abruptly. "Idiot!" she screamed at her brother, and running to the chair threw herself on it, sobbing so violently that she could not stop for a long time. "It's nothing, Mama, really it's nothing, only Petya startled me," she said, trying to smile, but her tears still flowed and sobs still choked her. the mummers, some of the house serfs, dressed up as bears, Turks, innkeepers, and ladies, frightening and funny, bringing in with them the cold from outside and a feeling of gaiety, crowded, at first timidly, in the anteroom, then hiding behind one another, they pushed into the ballroom where, shyly at first, and then more and more merrily and heartily, they started singing, dancing, and playing Christmas games. The Countess, when she had identified them and laughed at their costumes, went into the drawing room, and the Count sat in the ballroom, smiling radiantly and applauding the players. The young people had disappeared. Half an hour later, there appeared among the other mummers in the ballroom an old lady in a hooped skirt. This was Nicholas. A Turkish girl was Petya. A clown was Dimla. An hussar was Natasha. And a Circassian was Sonya, with burnt cork, mustache, and eyebrows. After the condescending surprise, non-recognition, and praise of those who were not themselves dressed up, the young people decided that their costumes were so good that they ought to be shown elsewhere. Nicholas, who, as the roads were in splendid condition, wanted to take them all for a drive in his troika, proposed to take them about a dozen of the serf mummers and drive to uncle's.
"No, why disturb the old fellow?" said the Countess. "Besides, you wouldn't have room to turn round here. If you must go, go to the Malyukovs." Malyukova was a widow who, with her family and their tutors and governesses, lived 3 miles from the Rostovs. "That's right, my dear," chimed in the old Count, thoroughly aroused. "I'll dress up at once and go with them. I'll make Pashet open her eyes." But the Countess would not agree to his going. He had had a bad leg all these last days. It was decided that the Count must not go, but that if Luisa Ivanovna, Madame Schoss, would go with them, the young ladies might go to the Malyukovs. Sonya, generally so timid and shy, begging Luisa Ivanovna not to refuse more urgently than anyone. Sonya's costume was the best of all. Her mustache and eyebrows were extraordinarily becoming. Everyone told her she looked very handsome, and she was in a spirited and energetic mood, unusual with her. Some in a voice told her that now or never her fate would be decided, and in her male attire she seemed quite a different person. Luisa Ivanovna consented to go, and in half an hour 4 troika sledges with large and small bells, their runners squeaking and whistling over the frozen snow, drove up to the porch. Natasha was foremost in setting a merry holiday tone, which, passing from one to another, grew stronger and stronger, and reached its climax when they all came out into the frost and got into the sledges, talking, calling to one another, laughing and shouting. 2 of the troikas were the usual household sledges. The 3rd was the old Count with a trotter from the Orlov stud as shaft horse. The 4th was Nicholas's with a short, shaggy black shaft horse. Nicholas, in his old lady's dress, over which he had belted his hussar overcoat, stood in the middle of the sledge, reins in hand. It was so light that he could see the moonlight reflected from the metal harnesses, discs, and from the eyes of the horses, who looked round in alarm at the noisy party under the shadow of the porch roof. Natasha, Sonya, Madame Schoss, and 2 maids got into Nicholas's sledge. Dimla, his wife, and Petya into the old Count's, and the rest of the mummers seated themselves in the other 2 sledges. "You go ahead, Zakhar," shouted Nicholas to his father's coachman, wishing for a chance to race past him. The old Count's troika, with Dimla and his party, started forward, squeaking on its runners as though freezing to the snow, its deep-toned bell clanging. The side horses, pressing against the shafts of the middle horse, sank in the snow, which was dry and glittered like sugar, and threw it up. Nicholas set off following the sledge. Behind him the others moved noisily, their runners squeaking. At first they drove at a steady trot along the narrow road.
While they drove past the garden, the shadows of the bare trees often fell across the road and hid the brilliant moonlight. But as soon as they were past the fence, the snowy plain, bathed in moonlight and motionless, spread out before them glittering like diamonds and dappled with bluish shadows. Bang, bang, went the first sledge over a cradle hole in the snow of the road, and each of the other sledges jolted in the same way, and rudely breaking the frost-bound stillness, the troikas began to speed along the road one after the other. A hare's track, a lot of tracks, rang out Natasha's voice through the frost-bound air. How light it is, Nicholas, came Sonya's voice. Nicholas glanced round at Sonya and bent down to see her face closer. Quite a new sweet face with black eyebrows and moustaches peeped up at him from her sable furs, so close and yet so distant in the moonlight. That used to be Sonya, thought he, and looked at her closer and smiled. What is it, Nicholas? Nothing, said he, and turned again to the horses. When they came out onto the beaten high road, polished by sledge runners and cut up by rough shod hoofs, the marks of which were visible in the moonlight, the horses began to tug at the reins of their own accord and increased their speed. The near side horse, arching his head and breaking into a short canter, tugged at his traces. The shaft horse swayed from side to side, moving his ears as if asking, "Isn't it time to begin now?" In front, already far ahead, the deep bell of the sledge ringing farther and farther off, the black horses driven by Zakhar could be clearly seen against the white snow. From that sledge one could hear the shouts and laughter and voices of the mummers. "Gee up, my darlings," shouted Nicholas, pulling the reins to one side and flourishing the whip. It was only by the keener wind that met them that the jerks given by the side horses who pulled harder, ever increasing their gallop, that one noticed how fast the troika was flying. Nicholas looked back. With screams, squeals, and waving of whips that caused even the shaft horses to gallop, the other sledges followed. The shaft horse swung steadily beneath the barrow over its head, with no thought of slackening pace and ready to put on speed when required. Nicholas overtook the first sledge. They were driving downhill and coming out upon a broad, trodden track across a meadow near a river. "Where are we?" thought he. "It's the Korsoy Meadow, I suppose. But no, this is something new I've never seen before. This isn't the Korsoy Meadow, nor the Demkin Hill. And heaven only knows what it is. It's something new and enchanted. Well, whatever it may be." And shouting to his horses, he began to pass the first sledge. Zakhar held back his horses and turned his face, which was already covered with a hoar frost, to his eyebrows. Nicholas gave the horses the rein, and Zakhar, stretching out his arms, clucked his tongue and let his horses go. "Now look out, master," he cried. Faster still the two troikas flew side by side, and faster moved the feet of the galloping side horses. Nicholas began to draw ahead. Zakhar, while still keeping his arms extended, raised one hand with the reins. "No, you won't, master," he shouted. Nicholas put all his horses to a gallop and passed Zakhar. The horses showered the fine dry snow on the faces of those in the sledge. Beside them sounded quick ringing bells, and they caught confused glimpses and of swiftly moving legs and the shadows of the troika they were passing. The whistling sound of the runners on the snow and the voices of the girls shrieking were heard from different sides. Again checking the horses, Nicholas looked around him. They were still surrounded by the magic plain bathed in moonlight and spangled with stars. "Zakhar is shouting that I should turn to the left." "But why to the left?" thought Nicholas. "Are we going to Malyukov's? Is this Malyukova? Heaven only knows where we are going, and heaven knows what is happening to us. But it is very strange and pleasant, whatever it is." And he looked around in the sledge. "Look, his moustache and eyelashes are all white. said one of the strange, pretty unfamiliar people, the one with fine eyebrows and moustache. I think this used to be Natasha, thought Nicholas. And that was Madame Schoss, but perhaps it's not. And this Circassian with the moustache, I don't know, but I love her. Aren't you cold? He asked. They did not answer, but began to laugh. Dimmler, from the sledge behind, shouted something, probably something funny, but they could not make out what he said. Yes, yes, some voices answered, laughing. But here was a fairy forest with black moving shadows and a glitter of diamonds and a flight of marble steps and the silver roofs of fairy buildings and the shrill yells of some animals. And if this really is Malyokova, it is still stranger that we drove heaven knows where and we have come to Malyokova, thought Nicholas. It really was Melyukovna, and maids and footmen with merry faces came running out to the porch carrying candles. Who is it? Asked someone in the porch. The mummers from the Count's, I know by the horses, replied some voices. All right, there we have it, another chapter down, a little bit of Christmas joy. Christmas magic is in the air. You know, I thought that was building up to some kind of, like, crash. I think someone in one of the comments from a few chapters ago said, like, they could see a high-speed horse crash happening, a devastating horse-based tragedy, and that was in my head, and I just thought that build-up was, oh no, they're going to crash. And I also kept thinking, wow, even 200 years ago, boys would just race in their cars, although it wasn't quite a car, but you know what I mean. Nothing's changed. Reddit user PuffleHuffy said, okay, who else thought there was going to be a sleigh crash and all their talk of dying was going to be foreshadowing? Obi-Wan Spicoli said, I was bracing for it. I was scared for Natasha especially. I thought she was a goner. Apparently I wasn't the only one thinking along those lines. DeFleury hijacked the conversation by saying, thank you for subscribing to Horse Facts, the Orlov Trotter breed, which is pulling Count Rostov's Troika, still exists today. It's a big, strong pedigree animal, specially bred for harness racing sport. In comparison, Nicholas is driving a short, shaggy animal that probably ploughs fields in the summer and does odd jobs around the house. If Nicholas ended up in front, it's because the old Count's driver was letting him win. Never bet on harness racing, folks, unless you know in advance which horse the drivers have decided is going to win that day. Well, there you go. Seems like Nicholas, he puts a lot of his pride on the line with these races and, you know, this competition with his dog in the hunting sport. And it seems like in a lot of cases, people are sort of humouring him and letting him win. Turtle Vader asks the question, the first part of this chapter finds the Rostov children reminiscing about their childhood while also philosophizing about life and or after death. Sorry, life before and or after death. Dimmler joins the conversation, but only says, yes, but it's hard for us to imagine eternity. Before the chapter moves on, do you think Tolstoy included this little blurb to say anything specific or meaningful? I think so. I personally think that it's got to do with he's an older fellow and talking to younger people. And I think in a lot of cases, when you're talking to younger people about philosophy, you're just trying to wrap their head around the scale of time most of the time. A young adult, someone who's 18 or so, has really only been an adult for a couple of years at most, and they've really only been in their adult mind for a self-conscious mind for a few years. And so life to them, the first 15 years of life, is kind of irrelevant when they're trying to think about life as an adult. It's really, they've only got the last few years as a basis. Whereas if you're 50, you've got, you know, maybe quite literally 50 times as much life experience. Maybe it's something like that. Or maybe he's just a deep and thoughtful person and saw these young people philosophizing and wanted to get involved, but didn't really know what to say. So he just chimed in with a little comment, "Yes, but it's hard for us to imagine eternity." Biscuit Potter said, "It's so weird to me that Dimmler has these lines in the book when he's an actual real guy who was just a musician. How weird would it be if he read this book? Imagine getting fictionalized into a minor character like that." I did not realize that Dimmler was a real person. That's pretty cool. This chapter, I think, is quite a long chapter, and I don't think it was one that just kind of... I think this chapter is one that was really meticulously planned. I don't think it was one that was just kind of written. Like, those hunting ones just sort of seem to be consequential. Tolstoy went away hunting, so he wrote some hunting chapters. But this chapter seemed really meticulously planned to me, in the sense that it started with the Rostovs reminiscing about childhood, talking about childhood, and trying to just remember things and thinking, was that real? Was that a real memory? Did that really happen? And then they moved to sort of philosophizing. And then they go on this Christmas miracle night, you know, this magic of Christmas kind of thing, and Nicholas is talking about there's fairies and there's magic and fairy houses, and so it's all very fantastical, and even the people surrounding him are in costumes, and it's very kind of splendid, and it's that same thing they were talking about at the start of their memories. It's like, was that real or not? Like, that's so surreal. And then they go out and they have this really surreal experience out in their sleds. I think what we're seeing there is Tolstoy setting them up to move out of childhood once and for all. These characters are coming of age, and this is their last little hurrah in the magic of childhood before they're going to come across some very real, very adult problems. And maybe not problems, but situations. That's what I really think the meaning of this chapter was. I would say that that is the little respite before the storm, the little grace note before the chaos begins. And with that in mind, I think we all know that the Rostovs are heading for financial ruin. So maybe that's the chaos that's about to begin. That would be my prediction of what we've just read. The children are going to be confronted with some pretty stark and some pretty unhappy reality in the coming chapters. Anyway, on that note, I'm going to end this episode here. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.